I have to close this excellent conference. Peter said almost everything I wanted to say this morning, and I'm fascinated by mitis because I think the Sufis don't have such a nice phrase for it, but they use it all the time. Just being very, very deceptive. Anyway, yesterday, was it only yesterday? Yeah, yesterday. Yesterday I was talking about how, just remember just to be here for the last, I know it's sunny outside and your bags are packed, and Peter took us into the depths of silence, and you probably had enough words to for a while. Yesterday I spoke about this moment, this period being a time of grace before a civilization dying. And this morning I was kind of reluctantly impressed upon me the second bit of that phrase, which is that you are the moment of grace. This is a time of grace, this is a moment of grace, and you are the moment of grace, because that's why I was interested about Peter talking about this realization he had that kind of he was the mitis. You know, it wasn't somewhere else. One of the legacies of our patriarchal culture is that it comes from somewhere else. And we have the transcendent God, so grace, help, energy of transformation, whatever it is, must come from somewhere else. And this is also part of a kind of, as we step out of a adolescent culture in which there are still these parent figures, spiritual or otherwise, into a kind of greater maturity, you then have to embody something yourself. And really, as mystics, as Sufis, as lovers, you know, we are in the grace business. Just as we're in the love business, we are in the grace business. We know we can't do anything without grace. You can't take a step on the path without grace. Rumi says quite categorically, by your own efforts, you cannot even get to the very first way station. So by now we know about grace. And if there is grace to help this civilization transform, to help it both die and be reborn, it's going to come from people like us. Not just us, but those around the world who are also in the grace business, who are at this place where the two seas meet. You know the story of Khidr, that he is found where the two seas meet. That means where the inner and the outer world come together, where the divine and the human come together. And one thing you realize on the mystical path, I always like this, you know, saying by Jami, why listen to second-hand reports when you can hear the beloved speak himself? What makes a mystic different is a mystic wants, even at sometimes demands, direct revelation. We don't want somebody else to tell us how it is. We want to know ourselves. We don't want to believe, we want to know. We want direct experience, and Khidr is the archetype of direct revelation, direct experience, which is why we follow the way of Khidr. Which means we live where the two seas meet. We live where the outer and the inner world come together. And for those of you who follow the Naqshbandi path, this is impressed in one of our central practices, outwardly to be with the people, inwardly to be with God. So that means we are this doorway between the worlds. That is also part of the esoteric meaning of to be the people of the secret. Most people are stuck in the outer world. Yes, they may be influenced by their unconscious, but they don't have the same direct access to the inner world of grace. It hasn't been given to them. It is like somebody years ago said to me, there are, and I don't really like to differentiate, but said there are two sorts of people, those who know and those who don't know. And we are here because somewhere we know. We know there is a reality with a capital R. And it isn't in the shopping malls. I mean, it's not in the shopping malls, but it isn't just in the shopping malls. So we are the moment of grace for the world. That's why years ago there was this poem that was supposed to be written by the Hopi elders, but actually wasn't written by the Hopi elders, we discovered later, which had this line in it that said, "We are the ones we have been waiting for." I'm sure many of you kind of went the rounds. I actually read it myself at a Sufi conference years ago. And we are the ones we have been waiting for. This complete embodiment of divine presence that Peter was talking about in his tradition of Mitis, of being that presence, that awareness, that attentiveness that is both human and divine. The world is not going to be transformed by some deus out there, deus absconditus, you know? It tried, it didn't work. It is really, this has to do with, you see, what happens when humanity takes an evolutionary step? It happens on all levels. Just when you go through a step, the changes happen on all levels. And so we know we have to take ecological responsibility for our planet. Yeah? That is apparent, that is obvious. Everybody knows that. But what we haven't realized is we also have to take spiritual responsibility for our planet. And we are kind of, I don't like to use the phrase, but the reality, we are kind of the elder brethren. It isn't just those wonderful tribe in South America, the Kogi, who are the elder brethren. Those who have direct access to the divine, which is what mystics do, because mystics are not made, they are born. You come into the world, Mrs. Tweedy said, you've got to screw loose. You don't take the world of appearances as what is. You're born a mystic, you're born with this screw loose that gives you direct access to another reality. Yes, it might be veiled and you might have to work to remove the veils, but it's only veiled, it's not kind of locked with a steel door and bolted like it is for most people. That's why everybody else thinks we're crazy. I always remember a dream I had years ago when I come from a very solid middle class English, you know, background. They're the kind of type that multiply and inherit the earth. Any of you ever read Howard's End? That's the type of family, you know, very, very successful. Everybody's very successful. But when I was about 22, I had a dream in which I saw they all thought I was crazy. You know, and for them, this is the world that it is, the world of the senses, the world in which you are a financial success. Because they don't have access to anything else. That's all they have. But we do. Otherwise we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have been turned on. We wouldn't have gone through this experience of Tauba, the initial turning of the heart. For ordinary people, Tauba is repentance. For mystics, it is the awakening of the heart. It is the beginning of the journey. It is that moment of divine grace when the beloved looks into the heart of his lover and with that glance awakens you to divine presence. That is what brings you to the path. This is what when somebody, rich person, asked Rabia, if I renounce the world and turn towards God, will he turn towards me? And she said, no, never. First, he has to look at you. Then you look at him. And it is that direct experience. He doesn't look through the eyes of a priest or the eyes of an organization or the eyes of a hierarchy. For mystics, he looks into your heart. It is this direct revelation that is the imprint of Khidr, that is the beginning of the mystical journey that contains all there is. And that is this experience of grace. It doesn't happen because you worked hard. You don't deserve it. So many times people come to me and they say, but I don't deserve it. And I say, none of us deserve it. And it has nothing to do with being chosen or whatever, because it just is. And he doesn't, do it because we are the best people. There are much better people who do much better things with their lives. They are really, really good people. But we have this screw loose. We are a little bit crazy. We want to be in love with our beloved for the rest of our lives. And we are prepared to pay any price he asks. That is crazy, isn't it? No. At least have some sensible Hollywood romantic dream. So, we are this place where grace happens, directly. That is the secret of the mystical journey. Yes, we do practices to help the grace to work within us. We do prayers, we do devotions, we do breathing, we do the zikr to help the grace come right through even to the cells of the body. That is our little contribution. My sheikh, he said, 90% or even 99% is given. You think, he said to Mrs. Tweedy, you think what you do is big effort. And she had to give away all her money and went through all this experience of Kundalini awakening and all the rejection and the betrayal and everything. And he said, you think what you do is a big effort. It isn't. He said, from my point of view, it is little because it is given. Everything is given. So what we do is in our practices, in our attention, in listening within, in all the spiritual qualities we develop, we are learning to work with grace, with what is given from within. And if there was no grace, then it would be, like pedaling one of those stationary bicycles. I think you do it in the gym, You get very fit, but you don't go anywhere. And remember what I said on Friday evening, that we tend to be a little identified with, it's about me, and even it's about my spiritual journey. Because that's where our society has taken us, in this focus on the individual. And as Peter beautifully said, that there is only one. It's never about me, because the one great illusion is the me. I mean, it's fascinating to see how the me is created. And I've had in the last few years this wonderful experience with my grandchildren of seeing how the me is created. I was always intrigued with my granddaughter. At the beginning, she always spoke about herself in the third person. At the beginning, she'd always talk about, her name's Myrtle, she'd always talk about Myrtle being somebody else. It happened to Myrtle. It took a few years for her to realize it was her. So you see how this me is created. You didn't come with it. There was no me when you were born. There was just pure experience in that first cry of a child that there's no me, it's just life. And that's part of the whole joy and beauty that somehow in a child being born, it reminds us of what we were before we were. It reminds us of how we really are somewhere. So it's, you know, one of the things is that you learn on the path is like Peter said, you go back to the very beginning, you go back to the foundation. And anything that you didn't come with, you can get rid of. Because it's not essential. That's why they say, you know, you are born naked and when you come to a teacher, you should be naked. Because part of the spiritual work is to get rid of everything. You don't get anything spiritually. This is, again, we're in the getting world. You know, in this culture, we want to get. We want to accumulate. And so we just transpose that, of course, onto we no longer want Walmart, but we want spiritual things. And one thing you realize on mystical path, it's not about getting, it's about removing. To go back to what is essential within you. And so essentially there wasn't an I. There was just life. There was just the one. So if you can... I've said this before in different ways, but traditionally the only way you could work with grace for the world was when you had completed the mystical journey. And I always use the, because I have this kind of Zen background, I always use the ox herding pictures, this wonderful description of the stages of the journey described in the Zen manuals of the young man who searches for the ox, who finds the ox, who transforms the ox, who rides on the back of the ox, and then goes to the source of the stream, and then as an old man goes back into the marketplace, and everything he looks upon becomes enlightened. He doesn't do anything, he just is. But that state of being is so essential, is so much to do with the core of life, that everything he looks on is awakened to its true nature. And traditionally, you could only get involved with work for the whole on the spiritual level when you had realized your divine oneness in full consciousness. When you had gone from fana to bhaka, and you abide in God. And what happens at that stage, traditionally, is then you get given a whole lot of other spiritual teachings. There's one set of spiritual teachings about making the journey, and Piaget gave us a beautiful description of one set of those teachings yesterday. They're very, very beautiful, and Sufis have given very, very elaborate descriptions of the stages of the journey. And then what is not so well known in the West is there's a whole other set of teachings that you start to get given when you have made the journey. And this is actually in our recent tradition, it's beautifully described by Mrs. Tweedy, because just before Baisab died, she was talking to him about spiritual training, and he said, spiritual training? I haven't even begun. And, you know, she'd given away everything she possessed, all her money, all of her savings. She'd had these very painful transformative experiences and sat with him for 5 years. And he said, spiritual training, I hadn't even begun. And then he died. And she was left there, you know, with nothing. She had a war widow's pension, which in those days was 10 shillings a week, which is like, you know, now it's $1 a week, right? Not a lot. Even in those days, even in the 60s. So only afterwards, after he died, when she was on retreat in the Himalayas, then one night when she was in deep meditation, he came to her and he started to train her. And that is traditionally the next stage of the spiritual training that happens really after the state of fana. And it isn't well known in the West because it's not written down. Because it's just not written down. Now, say traditionally, you only get those teachings after you've made the journey. But because we are at this moment of global crisis, there is the rules change. And the different set of rules is anybody who has access, conscious access to divine unity, who can step in, even just for an instant, into the arena of oneness, is allowed to participate in work for the whole. Because there aren't so many people around the world who have made the whole journey. It takes a long time, it's very labor intensive, and traditionally there aren't so many, and there's so much work that needs to be done now, so much grace needs to be given to the world. Enormous amounts of grace in the next few years have to pour into the world, because that is what happens when something dies, to help it to complete that cycle and to be transformed. And it's just too much grace to come through the few hundred people around the world who've actually made the whole mystical journey. So the doors of grace have opened much wider. And that means that anybody who is prepared to work for the whole and who has conscious access to that dimension within themselves can work with that grace, not just for themselves and their own spiritual progress, but for the whole. Now, again, try to realize this is not about you. This is not about, oh, I get the opportunity to work for the whole. Think that it's about life. And if you realize you're just a part of life or a part of God, it doesn't matter, it's all the same. And something in you is responding to this divine moment, to this need. That is all. Then you don't have to think, I'm special, I get to work with grace for the whole. Because then you get on this horrible celestial ego trip, which means you can't do anything except make more spiritual images and more spiritual fantasies, no longer just about your own spiritual progress, but about the spiritual progress of the whole. And that it looks very pretty up there, but it doesn't actually do anything. But if you realize that life is bringing together, if you like, certain light cells, this is just an image, it's not completely true, but bringing together certain light cells to work with its own spiritual energy. And so a gathering like this is a bringing together of certain light cells and to work with a certain energy. And that's why it's very important that there are different traditions coming here, because if there was just one tradition, you'd only get one set of spiritual light cells. For example, in our Naqshbandi tradition, we work with a light that is golden yellow. Excuse me. Which is why I was told to call our center the Golden Sufi Center, because we are the Golden Sufis, because the color of the light that we work with is golden yellow. The Chisti light has a slightly different frequency. It's a different color. Now, if you bring different colors together, then different things can happen than if you just work with one color. It allows, if you like, the energy to be magnified, to radiate and to resonate in different ways. I remember, for example, when I first met Piazia and I saw that he was working him and his tradition was working in a very different frequency to the way our tradition works. And I saw that if we worked together, we could cover a much bigger spectrum of light, of consciousness. Because, for example, the Naqshbandi tradition works primarily in the planes of non-being, in the planes of non-existence. It comes down into the planes of being, while the Chisti tradition, as far as I understand, works more in the angelic planes. And if we combine together, then we had a whole spectrum of consciousness. And each other tradition or path that works together, you add that vibration, that frequency, that energy of grace. And that is really all. So, just to kind of recap, because we are at this transitional point in the civilization, things are dying. And it's very, very important at this time not to judge anything by its appearances, please. As Sufis, we are trained not to judge things by their appearances. In the same way as Peter was saying before, you know, this also seems to be part of his teaching. The world is a deception. And he is the greatest of deceivers. And you can only play the game once you realize you're being deceived. If you try to do everything correctly, it won't work. And anybody who's worked in the Sufi tradition should know that. The one thing that is sure is you're going to get conned. It is just, you know, you just have to read Nasruddin. That's why you need a sense of humor. If you can't laugh at yourself, find a good, serious spiritual path that will take you to a good, serious spiritual heaven. But don't sit in the company of Sufis. So, you realize this world is a world of appearances. Now, the great advantage of it being a world of appearances is appearances can change much more quickly than things that are fixed and static. If something is fixed and static, you've got to dig it up. You've got to blast away at the roots. But if it's just an appearance, you can change an appearance, or an appearance can be changed. That's the only reason I have hope for the world. That the veils can be shifted, the appearances can be shifted. But they need a certain energy to shift. And at the moment, for some reason, I don't quite understand, the geopolitical economic environment doesn't seem to be providing that energy to shift the appearances. They seem to rather like the appearances as they are. It doesn't make a lot of sense, because if you look around you, it's not a good situation. But anyway. So, as Peter was saying, we have to believe in something that is impossible. But we do that anyway because we are mystics. I mean, it is completely impossible to have union with God. Completely impossible. But that's what we believe in. I mean, it's completely impossible because it's totally true, but that's a whole other issue. Because we're always one with God. But, and so we, by our nature, believe in impossible projects. Which means we believe in grace. You can't take a step on the path without grace. You can't even find a path without grace. And grace is really all we have. That and spiritual friendship, which is also grace. I don't know how much you realize the importance of spiritual friendship, which is part of what happens in a gathering like this. It's very, very, very precious. It is. Some nice sayings on that. Maybe I should. You probably listened to enough nice sayings, but I suddenly remembered I had thought about this before. This is one of my favorite by Abu Sa'id. 4,000 years before God created these bodies, he created the souls and kept them beside him and shed a light upon them. He knew what quantity each soul received, and he showed favor to each in proportion to its illumination. The souls remained all that time in light until they became fully nourished. Those who in this world live in joy and agreement with one another must have been akin to one another in that place. Here they love one another and are called the friends of God, and they are brothers and sisters who love one another for God's sake. These souls know one another by smell like horses. So that's how we find each other in this world. by smell, you know, spiritual smell, the odor of sanctity, you know, that sweet fragrance that comes from our meditation. We kind of find one another. But then there is this sweetness of spiritual friendship. Now, again, you think, oh, it's wonderful I have spiritual friends. And it is, and it's much more significant than most of us are aware. It's like this saying by, I think this is also Abu Sa'id, what was more pleasing in the world than when lover went with lover, the friend with friend? The rest was only grief, while that was all joy. The rest was only talk, while that was all deed. It's very beautiful, this spiritual friendship. But from the point of view of the beloved, if you look at this saying by Abu Kahir, he created these bodies of light in his world, not in this physical world. He created them in the world of light. He created them with a certain energy of remembrance in the world of light. And then they come into this world, and you come into this world through different families, and then you are pulled back into this body of light. Yes, in this world we recognize each other by smell, because smell is the highest of the senses for the Sufis. It's closest to the essence. That's why the Sufis talk about following the fragrance of the rose, the fragrance of the musk deer. It's the highest of the senses. So something in you, some spiritual sense in you, draws you into spiritual companionship. And now at this time, there is a certain work of grace that is done through spiritual bodies in this world, through a coming together like this. A certain grace is given, is brought into, from the inner worlds into the planes of existence, into the planes of creation, where both the images, the appearances of the world need this grace to transform, and also actually the very cells of the physical world also need this grace, because they too have to transform at this time in the transition of the world. It's a very big transition that isn't just cultural transition, it also, the very energy structure of life itself is also being transformed. The way matter works is being transformed. And it doesn't need like, you know, big systems of grace, because it's never like that. You can put just a droplet of love into one person's heart, and that is all they need for the whole of their life. You know, we live in a culture that says bigger is better, and to change the world, you have to have lots of organizations. But, you know, as Peter showed us, it was just two people, you know, 2,500 years ago that created this Western civilization. Why? Because they had access to something else and they knew how to work with it in this world. So as the fools of God, as his own idiots, we are a place, not the place, but we are a place where grace is being given to the world. And it is a responsibility that we have, because we have been given grace. We wouldn't be here, we wouldn't have taken a step on the path unless we were given grace. And as Sufis, we know we are never given for ourselves, it is always for others. It's always for others, and the others is also the world. It's not just some spiritual others. The others is also the world. So we have a responsibility. Tough. You can't anymore go off and do your practice in secret, because it belongs to the world. It belongs to life. The rule book changed, you may not have noticed. It belongs to life itself. Life needs it. Life needs this energy, this spiritual energy to transform, and it is being given this energy to transform. That is the law. Before something dies, there is a time of grace. What we didn't realize is we are where grace happens for the world. That is part of our spiritual responsibility. If you don't want to do that, yes, you can continue your own spiritual practice on your own. I don't know where it will take you. God bless. But as Sufis, we are here for our beloved. We are not here for ourselves. So it is time to grow up and to step out of this isolated image of my spiritual path, my spiritual practice. I'm going to realize something. Because it was never meant to be that. It was never meant to be about my. It was always for the whole, because it is about oneness. And if there is oneness, there is oneness. And that means you are the oneness. And if you have spiritual awareness yourself, you are the spiritual awareness of oneness. And if you have grace, you are the grace of oneness, of life. You are the grace that is needed. And we are going to get given a lot more grace. And grace is not easy to bear, I can tell you. It does strange things to you. The more grace, the less you are for yourself. It is like people say, oh, they want more spiritual energy. But you give people more spiritual energy and it starts to do strange things to their life. Suddenly certain attachments start to fall away. Things don't work so smoothly. Because you get more energy, more power. The ego doesn't like it. The mind doesn't like it. I always remember when Mrs. Tweedy, when I first knew her, she lived in a little, what they call in America, elegantly, a studio apartment. In England we call them bedsits. And there was a young man in the group, and in this house there was a bedsit became vacant next to the one that she had. And he thought, hey, great, I'm moving in. And he asked the landlord lady, and she said, sure, he was a very nice person. And he asked Mrs. Tweedy, is it okay if he moved into the place next door to her? Wonderful. Sitting in the room next to the teacher. Oh, states of meditation, states of bliss. And she said, be careful what you ask for. He lasted 3 months. He said, I can't meditate, I can't sleep, I can't eat, I can't drink. It was too much energy, too much power. He ended up in Australia. So it is through us that grace is not going to be given, is being given to the world. Not just us, there are other people who are sufficiently crazy to also have signed on to this scheme. And they are being linked together in different ways. And I'm just telling you, it's going to get worse. Because the more close you get to things falling apart, the more grace is given. It's going to get more and more and more intense. I watched in myself. I thought, oh, you know, life's going to get easier now. And then unforeseen difficulties come up. Things I never would have guessed at. I won't tell you what they are because it would freak you out. But so we are the moment of grace. Sufis, we are children of the moment. And in this moment, the need is grace given to the world. Doesn't mean you have to do anything different, no. When we try to do something, we usually mess it up. The ego comes in. And don't try to live a spiritual life. That is usually a disaster. Try to live a life of presence and remembrance. That is something else. And it is always different to how you think it's going to be. And I'm really, really grateful that everybody, both the presenters and the people, you sitting here, came together to, because it's also experiment. This hasn't been done before in this way. Certainly hasn't been done in public. Not with some gentleman recording it, no. A few caves, you know, a few little places in the desert.
not in public.
So it is an experiment. We are part of a spiritual experiment. But it is needed. Sufis are needed in the world. They have always been needed in the world, but it has been mainly in the world, the hidden world, the worlds that are veiled from this world. But now we are needed right in the midst of the planes of creation. So now please forget everything I said and go home. Yeah. God bless.